Thanks, Duke. Good evening, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How you all doing? Thank you for that nice introduction, Duke, and thank the committee for inviting me here. This has been a fabulous convention, and I really appreciate all the work that all these committee members did, and it's just a pleasure to be here. I love AA, and I hope you'll understand that as I keep talking, how much I love it and how much fun it is to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Saw a cartoon, and I'm not picking on Vince, you know, California. I love California, but this was a cartoon of an AA meeting in California, and there's a guy up at the podium, and the caption says, "Hi, my name is Joe, and I represent Dan, who's an alcoholic." Oh, let's hope we never see that. Wouldn't that be something? The other story, one of the speakers at last year's convention, Bob B., was the Sunday morning speaker. And I was visiting with him down in Naples, right? Last year's convention was in Naples. And we were swapping stories about conventions. Now, you see, the speakers go to a lot of conventions, and we see funny things happen. You know, and banquet tables that get all mixed up and dance bands that don't show up and just funny stories. And he shared one. If you haven't heard this, this is a classic. He told me about going to a convention in Indiana. And he's like I am, that when he goes, he doesn't bring the fly, he doesn't bring anything. He just has the name of the guy that's meeting him at the airport and his phone number. So he arrived there, and you always find, you know, there's one person looking for somebody. So he's waiting for Joe, and pretty soon there's no one left in the airport area at his gate except a guy carrying a sign that says, "Captain Bob?" with a big question mark. And finally the guy with the sign came over. "You can, oh, I'm not Captain Bob." So he went to the phone and called Joe's number, and Joe's wife answered. And he said, "I'm Bob. I'm here for the AA convention." "Well, Joe went out to get you." "Well, he's not here. Where's the hotel?" So she gave him the hotel, and he got in the cab and went down there. And the committee was in the lobby waiting for him, looking a little chagrined. And they brought him in, and they said, "You're not going to believe what happened." But Joe went out there, and a very distinguished man, about 80 years old, in a suit, came walking down the stairs, and something told him that that was you. And it turned out that the guy coming down the stairs was Captain Bob. Who was coming to a family reunion being organized by his nephew, whose name was William. And so Joe walked up and said the two magic questions. "Are you Bob?" "Yes." "Are you a friend of Bill's?" "Yes." So that was it, right? You know, just, "Well, come on, I'm here to pick you up. I'm bringing you downtown. We got your room at a hotel." And Captain Bob's going, "Wow, I'm staying in a hotel. I thought I was staying in a house. This is wonderful." And bring him down, the welcoming committee to welcome him there. And he's just having a blast. And he introduced everybody to on the committee. And they take him in. Said, "Bob, we're just about to have lunch. Come on in." And they sat down. And they all almost passed out when their Saturday night speaker ordered a scotch and soda. So I think he has the best story I've ever heard about conventions. I got sober on Pearl Harbor Day of 1964, and My home group is the Saturday Night Live group in Tampa, Florida, and they're meeting now, and I'm just wish them well, and I'm really happy to be here. There's a lot of definitions of alcoholism, and there's one that I like, and there's a story that goes with it in our AA history. And it's from that story that I'd really like to talk tonight about my experience with alcoholism and with sobriety and the spiritual program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And some of you who love to study the history already know this story, but for those of you that are new, it's kind of interesting, and it concerns a very wealthy family in Rhode Island named the Hazard family. And they were very millionaires, big family business. And the oldest son, Roland, was due to inherit the business and all that. And the problem was that he was an alcoholic. And his father could not get him sober. He had all the money in the world to try and get him sober. And it was obvious that this young man might die an alcoholic or get committed. And so they finally, in talking to everybody, they said the best chance of him achieving sobriety and living would be to see Dr. Carl Jung in Switzerland. So they had plenty of money, and he went off to Switzerland and stayed in Dr. Jung's treatment for a year. And during that time, Dr. Jung tried to cause this personality transformation that we experience here in AA. And at the end of that time, he told young Roland, "Well, I've done everything I can for you. You understand your situation. You understand, yes, 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 I do. I'm very optimistic. I thank you." And he got as far as Paris. Somebody asked him the wrong question. He said, "Would you like a drink?" And he said, "Yes." And in no time at all, he was just drunk, all messed up, and went back to Dr. Jung and said, "Here I am again." And the world's greatest psychiatrist, when asked by Roland, what are we going to do, said to him, "There's nothing I can do for you." And I really think that at that point, symbolically, we could see that we're powerless over alcohol and our life was unmanageable and no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. That this was the epitome of human power. And this human power was looking the disease of alcoholism right in the face and said, "There is nothing I can do for you," inducing the surrender that we have in our first step, total surrender. You are powerless and I'm powerless over the disease. And so young Roland was quite shaken by this. He said, "You mean I'm going to die or end up locked up?" And he said, "Yes. I have read, however, of a few cases where people have found a spiritual transformation by associating themselves with some kind of a spiritual way of life. That's the only chance that I can think you have." And with that set up, he came back to the United States and got affiliated with the Oxford movement and started staying sober. Now, the Hazard family summered in Vermont, which is where Bill Wilson grew up and a lot of the cast of characters in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. Lois Burnham family vacationed in the summer up there, which is how Bill and Lois met. And over from Albany, New York, another wealthy family that summered there was Ebbie Thatcher. And at this particular moment in time, Ebbie was in front of a judge for about the fifth time after driving a car into a farmhouse kitchen and asking for a drink. And painting his house after the judge told him not to drink anymore, and he was painting his house and some birds messed up the paint, so he got a couple shotguns and sat in his front yard and blasted away at every bird that came by. The neighbors complained and he was back and the judge was going to send him away for a long time. And he said, "Well, could I make one phone call?" And he said, "Yes." So he called his buddy, Roland Hazard, who he knew had enough horsepower to maybe get him out of this. And when Roland, he didn't know he was in the Oxford movement and was sober. He just knew he had a lot of horsepower, political horsepower. So he came over, and the judge was willing to release Ebbie into Roland's care because this is, you know, like a bondsman to just have that family take him. So he took him to the Oxford movement. And after a couple of months, Ebbie started thinking about his drinking buddy Bill when he was transferred to New York to work in the church in New York. So he paid the call on Bill, and we all know the rest, that Bill had his magic moment in Towns Hospital, continued with the Oxford group, went out to Akron where Dr. Bob was already in the Oxford group, and the birth of Alcoholics Anonymous took place. And a number of years went by before Bill Wilson realized that he had never closed the loop with Dr. Young, that probably Dr. Young had no idea what he started when he told Roland Hazard that there was no human power and that he was going to have to find. So he wrote a long letter, and it turned out, I think it was in the 60s, that it was about 3 months before Dr. Young died. He got the letter from Bill, and you've probably seen in the grapevine, they have these exchange of letters that went back and forth. And basically, Bill was sharing, says, I don't know if you remember Roland Hazard, but as a result of your visit, blah, blah, the Oxford movement, and now here we have this wonderful thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. People's lives are being saved all over the world, and we want to formally acknowledge the wonderful role that you played in this story as it unfolded. And within a month or so, Bill got the letter back from Dr. Young, who expressed his pleasure at finding out about this. He said, I had lost track of Mr. Hazard, and I'm so happy to hear what happened to him. And he went on to say that at that particular point in time, it was almost professionally impossible for a psychiatrist to talk about spiritual things without being laughed out of his profession, but that Young had made enough progress now that it was okay for him to put in writing what he was thinking back in the early 1930s when he saw Roland Hazard. And that was that he saw alcoholism in a very special light. And he saw that the only thing that was going to really make the transformation was a spiritual higher power. And he came up with a way of looking at the disease that I particularly like. And he suggested that we as alcoholics, whether we know it or not, have an inordinate longing for God. And that that is what we're trying to fix all our lives, thinking that it's all these other things, that I'm insecure, that I had a funny childhood, that I had this, that I need money, or I need more sex, or I need power, a bigger job. And every time we went and got those things, there was still something missing. And we come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and they go, what you need to do is find a higher power. And lo and behold, that hole is finally gone. And so I like to put myself in that category. I like to think that that's really what was going on. That somehow I sensed that there was something missing in my life, and I was always wondering why I felt different and all these things. And when alcohol came along, it appeared to fix that spiritual problem. It appeared to fill that hole that I felt inside of me so that I was a complete person. And it wasn't until I got to AA that you told me and suggested to me that my problem was not all those things that I thought it was, that it was really an absence of a higher power. And I didn't believe it, but I had nowhere else to go. And so I followed the path, highly skeptical, and found out that you were right, that that was my problem, and that I was wrong. And when I finally was willing to admit it, I was able to have this wonderful life that we have here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So in that context, you know, I'd just like to lay that out, and then I can tell you my story, and maybe you'll see how all that ties in. I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut. I was born up there in 1931. My mother almost died when I was born. It was a big trauma. And some psychiatrists, when I finally found out about it and talked to them about it, they said, well, you never really made the transition from inside your mother to the earth because there was no one there. She had been put in a tub of ice and somebody left me somewhere for 3 or 4 hours and the doctor didn't know what he was doing. And I said, wow, well, what does that mean? And he says, well, you're supposed to be made safe so that you feel that you can stay here. And I went, well, I never did feel safe. And then I heard a speaker one time, and he had the perfect thing. And I'm sure you've heard a couple of people say this. He said that he always felt, especially as he got into his teenage years, and he loved to be alone, you know, loners and that kind of stuff, and that he'd be off on a hill, and he knew that any day a spaceship was going to land. And a couple of little creatures were going to get out and come running over and go, George, we're so sorry. We screwed up. You're not supposed to be on Earth. Come on. You're supposed to be up here on Uranus. And then he'd go, see, I knew I wasn't supposed to be here. I knew there was something different about me. And so I had, that's sort of the sense I had. I didn't know what it was, but I always had the feeling like, I'll be out of here soon, you know. But I'll pretend to be an earthling until then. Because all these other people really are earthlings. You know, they belong here. They all seem to be bonded. And then there was something inside of me that was telling me I wasn't one of them. And of course, once that's established inside of us, then we can get paranoid and worried that they're going to find out we're not one of them and be accused of being a phony. And so I always was worried that, you know, if somebody was going to, whenever I would move up, you know, if I got good grades or got up into a, because I believed I belonged down at the lowest level. I had that feeling. So anytime I was succeeding at anything, it was at high personal cost to me because it was very nervous to be there. So if I won something in athletics or got very high grades, and people would go, oh, you're one of us, and I knew some spy was going to show up and go, no, he's not. He's not. So this stuff is going on, and, you know, went to a church, and the church was scaring the heck out of me, and all the purgatory stuff that we've heard about, and I had all that and was terrified about it. But like everybody else, I had to keep that to myself because it seemed as if the ground rules for life are you don't ask directions. You figure it out yourself. This is how the game is played. And if you were to ask or to even hint that you didn't know everything, then the game would be over. They'd call a foul. You're out of here. You asked. It's over. You know, that kind of stuff. So I had all this information running around in my head, and I'm processing it all by myself, and I'm learning all these things. God hates me, and I'm not wanted here. I'll be going to another planet. But I'm trying to be cool like all the other guys. Yeah, man, I know everything. I'm not worried about a thing. I'm not fazed by anything. I'm just here, you know. So I was one of these guys who was terrified and thought you could get rid of fear by doing brave things. You know, so that's how I ended up being a steeplejack and joining the Marine Corps and being a fighter pilot. And there I am flying an airplane going, God, am I scared. This stuff doesn't work. You know, maybe I should become a ordnance disposal guy, or maybe I should become, I don't know what, you know. Bungee jumping had been around when I was a teenager. I would have been doing that. I mean, that was the type of stuff. None of it worked. You'd run out and do something brave or daring, and then you'd come back and everybody would say, wow, I can't believe you did that. And then I'd go home at night and I'd go, how about that? And then it was just this voice inside, you're nothing, man. I don't care what you do. You could jump off the Empire State Building. You are still nothing. Zero is your middle name. And there was that feeling. So zero is walking around trying to be equal with all the other people. And it was a real struggle. So I grew up there, and my parents worked real hard to, during the Depression and the aftermath, to get me into a nice prep school. And the prep school fed right into Yale, which is the hometown university there. I went right over there, very high grades. I was doing good in athletics. And I got there, and I hadn't had a drink. But I got there, and now it was, I went out, you know, like a little fish in a little pond or a big fish in a big pond. Now I'm in this thing, and there's all these rich guys from all over. They all knew everything, had convertibles. And you could just sense this, you know, this power. And I said, oh, God, they're going to find out now. I fooled them in that little school, but this is going to be rough. And it was just terrifying. I was just sweating, trying to just be comfortable in a class or everything. But I was studying well, moving along, but I wasn't drinking. And my roommates kept saying, you're in college, you ought to be drowned. No, I'm not going to drink, I'm not going to be an athlete, I mean, I don't want to go to purgatory and get all those things. And so this is inside, and I'm just telling them, no, I don't feel like it or whatever. But there came a night when I just couldn't take it anymore. It was just too much, and I was in a situation, which even today I don't like that much, but it's like, okay, go in that room, there's 25, 30 other guys, and meet everybody. You know, just walk in and go, hi, and I say, well, could I just maybe jump off a building instead or something like that? No, go in that room and stay in there till you've met everybody. And so I went in there and nobody wanted to meet me. You know what I mean? It was just, I walked around, I started to stick my hand out, and they gave me that, don't even think about it. I put my hand back, and I'd go over there and go over here, and nobody wanted to meet me. They were mean. They were superior. It was a class thing. So I went over to the bar, and I said, you know, I feel so terrible. My roommates are telling me alcohol makes you feel wonderful. I'm entitled to feel wonderful. So I had a drink, and nothing happened. A second drink, and nothing happened. I was working on the third drink, thinking that alcohol is vastly overrated. Just sort of sipping away, you know, and put the glass down, and I said, well, the hell with it, I'm going to leave. And I started to go, and I looked up, and nothing had happened to me. I was exactly the same. But those 30 guys had gone, and they were replaced by 30 of the friendliest guys I have ever seen in my life. They were, everyone in that room wanted to know me. It was as if they all stopped talking and said, we'd give anything to know Sandy over there. Please come over and join our group. Please, please. And I'm looking around at these people. Well, please, you're going to come over? And I'm going, wow, this is great. Everybody thinks I'm wonderful. And then I felt something stronger. I just had a little spring in my step, and I was kind of, I'll get over there when I'm damn good and ready. You know, it's like, I just had the feeling they were so lucky to meet me. I was on my way over. What a great night for them. And just hello, hello, hello. And all the inhibitions went away, and I intuitively knew how to handle situations that were terrifying me. I could make small talk. I could remember people's names. It was just wonderful. I was transported into the fourth dimension of alcoholism. And I loved it there. It was absolutely wonderful. So I had more alcohol to stay there, and then I was throwing up, and then I was sick, and I was, oh, so bad the next day, just dragging around, dry heaving and all that. And I can remember saying to myself, okay, so you're throwing up, so you feel terrible, so you think you might die. This is a small price to pay for what you had last night. So I already made the bargain with the devil. I already decided that what alcohol did for me was worth anything, because it fixed the core problem that I had, that nothing had ever fixed before, that I had lived with since I was like 2 or 3 years old. This thing was gone now. And I was, as far as I was concerned, normal for the first time. And it made me so happy. I said, I should have started drinking in grammar school. I could have had a blast back there. I could have felt this sense of camaraderie and belonging and all of that. All these years of my life, and so there was no doubt in my mind that I was going to drink forever, that I now had the one missing ingredient to go through a wonderful life. All you have to do is have alcohol around and then add it to everything else that you're doing. And so I was an alcoholic that first night. That's how I became an alcoholic. I made a decision that alcohol was the answer to my problems in life. So alcohol didn't make me an alcoholic. I had all these problems, and alcohol fixed my problems. And that's why, as the years go by and I started getting all that trouble, and people would say to me, "Why don't you stop drinking?" And they said that to you, and you said the same thing I did. You said, "You don't understand. Alcohol is not my problem." Now, I didn't phrase it that way. Now I can see it much more clearly. But what I was saying to them was, my problem is not alcoholism. My problem is sobriety. That's my problem. Whenever I have no alcohol in my system, it is awful. That's why I went to a bar, to fix sobriety. You know what I'm saying? Oh, my God. I'm absolutely sober again. And I can't stand being sober. I'm going to explode. And that's what, you know, I never said those words to the bartender. Bartender, hi. You got something for sobriety back there? I don't know what the heck happened, but here I am, sober again. And it's some dumb, jerky me. And I can't stand it, so give me something. And he would give it, and I said, "That's the stuff. I like that stuff. It just gets rid of that sobriety and nothing flat. It takes me back into where I am a complete person. I am now able to function. I can relax. I don't have that feeling that I don't belong. I am just comfortable." So I was born with an alcohol shortage, is just the way I see it. That was what was missing, you know, like a battery doesn't have water in it and it just won't function, it's brand new and all of that. And then you pour it in, boom, all the power comes. And so whenever it got drained out of my system, I was useless. I was just like that. So I just said, I have to have alcohol all the time. I mean, it's going to be part of my daily routine. And so my life centered around this power source, this alcohol. And then I tried to live a normal life being powered by alcohol. That's my story as being an alcoholic. And if I got into a situation where I was off on a weekend, I didn't know there wasn't going to be any booze, it would be a disaster weekend. It was like being off on a weekend with no oxygen. You know, it's like, I think something's awful up here. Yeah, there's no oxygen. I don't think you can live without oxygen. I don't think you can live without booze. You know, it was that close. It was so close. You all know how close it was. It was total dependency on the power of alcohol to transform us in order. Now, not only did I have that problem, but now alcohol started adding the problems. Now you started adding in fights and bad grades and getting sick and judges and police fines and new clothes. Boom, teeth gone. Just boom, you just... You go out to have a martini, and it costs $1.50 for the martini and $250 dental stuff. You know what I mean? And so it's there's just all the associated problems with drinking that just got piled on top of the mere cost of drinking and the trouble. And my grades started going bad, and I started flunking out and getting, you know, in fights and trouble and... terrible personal relationships were a mess. Somehow I managed to graduate barely, and the Korean War was going on, and everybody had to join the military. And a bunch of guys were standing around drinking beer one Saturday afternoon, and we all were trying to decide, what are we going to do about this draft situation? And three guys said, "We're going to join the Marine Corps. You want to go with us?" yeah, let me finish my beer. And went down there and they call the recruiting sergeant, yeah, get these guys, you know. Signed us all up, and 3 months later, 2 months later, whatever it was, in late 1953, I was on a train down at Quantico, Virginia. And it was shocking. I couldn't believe this. You know, I'd read some brochures, and they had golf courses down there, and it really looked nice. And I couldn't believe what happened. I was just in a state of shock. And I got through that, and then we became a second lieutenant, and then we went 6 months of infantry training out in the mountains and hills and snow. And it was just so intense. I couldn't believe how intense it was. These guys were like, God, I wish there was somebody to kill around here today, you know. It's like, and I'm like, you know, hey, man, let's just take it easy. What's all this? Lighten up there, you know. So I'm sponsoring a Marine colonel down in Tampa right now, and he just talked to me for about an hour, just talking to me, you know, about Marine Corps things. And he said, I can tell you were a pilot, you know. And that's what happened. I was in the middle of all this intense stuff, getting ready to be a platoon leader to go sailing off to Korea. And I saw a movie about pilots, you know, a training movie that enticed people to go over for that. And they weren't doing any of this stuff. They were at a bar. There was some women in the background. They were flying these airplanes and all of that. So I went over and I said, I'd like to sign up for that. And they said, it'll 3 more years. Hey, what's 3 years? I'm not. Is it get me out of here? And they said, it gets you out of here. I want to be a pilot. And so that got me to Pensacola. And I got down to Pensacola, got married, made it through flight school, drinking like a, you know, crazy, but somehow made it through all those various things and went aboard a carrier off there on Pensacola Bay, and then went on to Corpus Christi for advanced training, and then went out to California, and then went off to a fighter squadron in Japan. And I'm telling you, I'm just loving it. I just think this is the greatest. I had a lot of natural talent in that area. And I spent a year over there and was drunk all the time. The parties, the pilots loved to party. And it was just, boy, I just said, I hope I stay here forever. And they came around and they said, we're handing out regular commissions. Would you like to make this a career? I said, yes, love to make this a career. Sign that thing. This is the greatest career I ever found. This is wonderful. You know, and I went on. Then I came back and I was a flight instructor at Pensacola and a forward air controller and doing this. But my alcoholism is now really progressing. And we had 1 kid, 2 kid, 3 kid, 4 kid, 5 kid, 6 kids. Tables getting crowded. You know, there's bills are piling up to here, and I'm like Mr. Responsible. You know, well, my wife, you know, I guess you'll have to handle this. I'm off on this secret mission or whatever it was. And so I was building up this remorse that I now have to live with of being a terrible husband and a terrible father, and thank God I've made all those amends, and all these various relationships have been straightened out as well as possible. But you can see that we just had a self-centered alcoholic whose hobby was flying airplanes. You know what I mean? And that was kind of what was going on. There came a time when the withdrawals, I was just drinking around the clock. I tried to not drink for 8 hours prior to getting in the plane. And I would show up and start into withdrawals. And that would cause me to panic. I couldn't see the instruments. I was shaking and, you know, and I had a couple of close calls. I was meant to hit this switch and I hit that switch and, oops, that was a mistake, you know. And whoa. So I was starting to get, I was already panicky all the time because I was born that way, but now I was getting more panicky. I used to leave all that fear on the ground when it took off. It was so exciting. It was like, boom, you'd blast off, and it was almost like drinking. I just left all that stuff on the ground, but now that was coming up with me. It was just. So I began to distrust the pilot of the plane I was in, which was me. And it was just very shaky. That went on for a year. I got into the F-8s and went into photo squadron, made it through photo school, and I was flying photo missions out of Cherry Point, North Carolina, and all kinds of stuff was happening. I would have to land halfway through the flight because I was going to black out, or I was going to have a seizure. I mean, I knew something was going to happen, so I had to make up excuses. The oxygen tanks went bad. Check that oxygen. They're checking. The captain, it's fine. Well, it wasn't when I was up there. It was terrible, and it was just becoming, you know, terrifying to get out of bed. So I went to the doctors. The doctors agreed that I shouldn't fly until I found out what this was. And I was sent down to Pensacola for 2 weeks, and I was examined by every doctor the Navy had, every kind. These were the top seed. And they needed pilots. I mean, at this point, Vietnam was about ready to start. The Marine Corps desperately needed pilots. So they're trying to go, we got to keep this guy, you know. Well, I get down there, and they look at me, and I got high blood pressure. My hands just shook all the time. And I had sweat. There was just a clammy sweat all over me. My eyes were all bloodshot. I was confused, and I reeked of alcohol. It just was. So they started studying me, and I went to the dentist, and I went here, and they. And you got to remember, this is in the early 60s. There was no alcohol program in the military. There was no diagnosis of alcoholism. It was just the dark ages, so I'm going through all this stuff. And I remember they had an old AD, Sky Raider, and they bolted a chair into that thing and put all these wires on me and put me in the chair and went up and did all these things. Well, do you feel the feeling you had? No, I don't feel the feeling. Well, we don't know what's wrong with you. It was just this long thing. And at the end of the time, they left it up to the psychiatrist because they couldn't find anything physically wrong. And a psychiatrist wrote up, and I still have all the papers, you are taken off of flight status due to a childhood fear of flying. After a couple thousand hours of jet time, they finally found that, and I was sent back to Cherry Point, and now Headquarters Marine Corps had to retrain me because they have someone who shouldn't have been a pilot. Otherwise, fine. So I got a set of orders in a couple months to Glencoe, Georgia, to become an air traffic controller. So I went to air traffic control and made it through the school. It's a very hard school, and I am now in the last 2 years of my drinking, going through that school. And then I was sent overseas to Japan, and I was the officer in charge of an air traffic control unit. This was the guy. And when the air group deployed somewhere, I went over, put up a tower, radar, zeroed in everything, and all their lives depended on the accuracy of what we did. And fortunately, there was a gunnery sergeant and senior enlisted in the unit, and he saw me when I arrived. Welcome aboard, Captain. Oh, good to have you here. Here's your little spot in the tent, and here's a little place for coffee, and don't go near the radar. You know, and he's... We'll take care of you. You just don't go messing around with any of this stuff. So that was what I did during that year, and I no longer had any restraints, like the 8 hours of not drinking. So I just drank around the clock, and I lost 50 pounds. I had malnutrition. I even stopped hanging out with my drinking buddies because I felt they were turning into enemies. So I was totally alone, trying to survive, just going to work. Just trying to remember my name, trying to remember where I was supposed to be. And it was the scariest year. And later on, after I got in AA, I met some of those guys back in the States here that I was with. And they all told me, they said, we knew you were dying of drinking, but we didn't know what we could do. And we really want to apologize. But nobody knew what to do. They just watched this. And I'm just trying to survive. And I made it through the year and was sent back to Quantico to go to a career school. You know, to become like a general or something. And I'm right on the edge of being psychotic from the alcohol to the point where I would come in the main gate of Quantico, Virginia, and I'd look up where the school was, and it was gone. And I would tell the sentry, Where's junior school? It was up here yesterday. He said, Captain, it's right up there. I was just up there. It's not up there. I can trust me. It's not up there. So they would escort me up. They'd have the siren going and take me up. Do you see the school? Oh, yeah, there it is. And I'd go in and I wouldn't know what classroom I was in. I'd be standing out just looking around. Somebody would get me and take me in. I wouldn't know what desk I was at, what assignment, combination lock. Forget it. I mean, a combination lock is. So it was just, you know, a guy right waiting to snap, and I'm trying to function. And it was just awful. It was really scary. And finally, I had a seizure in the school. And then that got everybody's attention. I was sent off to Bethesda. What caused the seizure? We're studying me again. What could have caused the seizure? He must be studying too hard. He must be either this and that. But after 4 days of withdrawal from alcohol, then I went to DTs. And the CIA was moving the walls in my room, and they were torturing me, and they were trying to get... And I took careful notes of all this stuff because I was going to turn them in to the commandant of the Marine Corps, and he would get them, and I don't know what they thought I knew. I don't know anything and all that. So, boom, I freak out, and they put me in a straitjacket, and I get locked up in the nut ward for 6 months. Just get in there. And so I'm in there, and I don't know what's wrong. I don't know what. It was just terrifying. And it was out of that environment that Alcoholics Anonymous came and talked the head psychiatrist into allowing an AA meeting in that nut ward because they had alcoholics there. Psychiatrist said, I'm not sure we have any, but if you want to have a meeting, you know, that's okay. Well, on the nut ward, the other patients, there were three alcoholics and maybe 35 other guys. And they did not consider alcoholism a mental illness and felt we were interlopers and definitely looked down on us. You know what I mean? Like, ooh, one of the drunks, you know what I mean? With they've schizophrenics and manic depressives and people tried suicide and all that. And then we had these three drunks and it was, you were like a little outcast over there. And it was really a strange place to be. But the funny thing is, after 6 months, it wasn't bad. You know what I mean? The only responsibility I had every day was to make a cup of tea. Watch the sun come up over here and watch the sun go down over there and go to clay class or whatever you're going to do. So Carmen came in one day and said, all drunks fall in, right face over the elevator. So the three of us are at the AA meeting. And these guys are excited. They're telling their stories. AA is the greatest thing in the world. I love it. I love it. I love it. And I'm going, wow, I believed them. I believe they were thrilled with this. And I said, give me your card. If I ever run into a guy with a drinking problem, I am sending him around to see you. And the guy's looking at me, you know, like, what? And he's giving me the Buck Doyle treatment. He was Mr. AA in Washington. He always poked people when he was talking, you know, just, hey. And he's going, let me ask you something. Yeah. And I'm going, you know, I just met the guy. He's going, oh, poke, poke, poke. He's saying, which one of us is going to put his coat on and go on out, get in his car and drive home to his family? And which one of us is going to put his little blue bathrobe on, go over in that elevator, go upstairs and get locked up like an animal? I said, this guy is rude. I mean, beyond, just met him. But it was my first exposure to the brutal honesty of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, like, where we finally say there's an elephant lying on the living room floor, you know. Like, someone finally said what everybody else had been watching and not saying anything about. And so I was made an outpatient while they're deciding what to do with me. And I went home, came back, went home, you know, at nights and then on weekends. And so eventually I decided to have a beer watching a Redskin game. And nothing happened. I slept like a baby. I came back to the nut ward on Monday. I said, I thought if you drank a beer, it said first drink gets you drunk. Nothing happened to me. I can't believe. I'm a former alcoholic is what I am. I'm just... drank that beer, and for the whole time during that week, all I could think about was the fact that I had one beer and nothing happened. I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat, I couldn't do anything because of this newfound freedom from alcohol. And that is an obsession. Just thinking about the fact that I had a drink and nothing happened. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. So then I started bringing vodka in, and they were going to catch me and everything. So I joined AA on the outside, and I got a sponsor came over. He's another Marine from Quantico, huge guy. He's still my sponsor, almost 35 years later. He came into my house. He's enormous. The walls shook when he knocked on the door, and he just came in. Okay, you, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. Get in the car. I'm not that bad a drunk. Oh, well, we'll find out. Gets my wife and kids. Tell me, is this guy, he's the worst father in the world. He's a terrible husband. And, take him away, never bring him back. And so it was like, he said, you're an alcoholic. Well, they exaggerate. Get in the car, and we're off to the meeting. And I haven't had a drink since. He just dragged me in that car, dragged me to all those meetings, dragged me. He was always doing things against my better judgment. Matter of fact, most of my sobriety has been against my better judgment. Every step of the way has been against my better judgment. But I had nowhere else to go, so I kept constantly taking actions that I knew wouldn't work. And I believe that's what the 12 steps are. They are a series of actions that we don't believe in. You sit up there and you read them, and if you're new and you've read those things, did they grab you? Could you read those and just go, oh, yeah, I see where that'll straighten out my... Makes sense to me. Pretty obvious to me, that'll just straighten out all this money, job, sex, it's all right there. I didn't see anything in there that pertained to me. I saw nothing that pertained to me in the 12 steps. And then I found out it only becomes visible after you do it. Because it's involving getting access to a power to transform the way we look at the world. Almost like alcohol did. You know, if you were to study alcohol, would you have known what it was going to do before you drank it? You know what I mean? Like, wow, it goes down, it goes into your legs, and it comes over here, and it goes up in there, and it runs over here. And if you don't know how to dance, you will shortly. I mean, would you have believed the power of booze if you never drank it? To this day, you'd be saying, that was just a joke that if you drank that, you would know how to dance. But those of us that drank it danced. You remember that? That was the power of alcohol, and that's all we're after here in the program, is power. We don't have it. We're powerless. And so we have to surrender to that fact. And I go back to that definition that I was talking about. My problem was not the list that I had. I didn't have enough money. I'm not strong enough. I'm not handsome enough. I'm not powerful enough. I don't have enough job. I don't have the right wife. I don't have a yacht. That is not my problem. My problem is I'm separated from my higher power. And it's hurting me. It's causing me to be drained of what I vitally need. So the problem that we have doesn't feel like that's the problem that we have. And that's the mystery of sobriety and spirituality. It never looks like that's the problem, and the answer never looks like that's the answer until we do it. And then problems in sobriety do not get solved. That's the difference. You know, intellectually, we solve problems. In Alcoholics Anonymous, when we work a spiritual program, the problems are simply removed. They just aren't there bothering us anymore. At some point, I stopped thinking about drinking. I didn't understand alcoholism any better than before it went away. I used to be obsessed with why I was an alcoholic. Now I could care less. It's some sort of an academic thing that I don't care if they ever find out. Because drinking is not harassing me in my mind at all. I don't think I've thought about taking a drink in 34 years. I've thought about suicide. But I haven't thought about taking a drink. It just doesn't come in to go, take a drink, take a drink, take a drink, take a drink. All that went away somewhere. I never figured it out. It was just lifted away. And I firmly believe that it will stay lifted away contingent on my spiritual condition. It's almost like alcoholism is a fire and you're being roasted over it. And you work the spiritual program and you get lifted up beyond the heat. And as long as you keep working that program, you stay there. And as soon as we stop maintaining this contact with a higher power, going to meetings, doing our meditation, prayer, whatever it is, then we start coming down again. Man, it's getting hot around here. This program isn't working. Something's happening. What's going on? Everything's getting screwed up. Oh, you're supposed to do the praying and stuff to get above the... Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Go right back up. And we can get a daily reprieve. And so I get into the system of expecting that this is the answer. And it takes a lot of years to realize I got to go against my own better judgment and follow this simple program. And I mean, that's why we have sponsors. That's why we go to meetings. You go, oh my God, the boss doesn't like my memo. What do I do? And they just go, well, pray, help a new guy, go to a meeting. That's a memo solution? Are you sure that's the memo solution? That sounds a lot like the financial insecurity solution. I mean, are you telling me there's one solution for all problems? Yes. Because the only problem we ever have is being away from our higher power. I know that if you're new, that's awful hard to believe. But if you could trust some of the old timers and the people who've been around here, this is, as Bill writes, our dilemma was lack of power. That's it. We're being overpowered by all these situations, and we're being overpowered because we're trying to do it alone. And we're trying to do it alone because our ego wants to get the credit for everything that happens. And when we finally understand some humility, we understand we can bring unlimited power into our lives, find life so much easier to live, but we have to give the credit to God. And the ego says, okay, I understand that. But wouldn't it be interesting to see if we could get through life without God? Now, wouldn't that be like more macho? I mean, wouldn't it be even superior to hanging around being dependent on a higher power? Yeah, I guess you're right. I'm going to go out today, handle everything on my own. And then we get squashed. Everything is just so because it's just us. And I think the longer we're sober, the only difference between new sobriety and old sobriety is how fast we pick the phone up. That's all. We just go, oh, I'm screwed up. You know what I mean? It's just like, boom, I feel myself getting disturbed. Life is overpowering me. Get the handkerchief out. I surrender. Hello, hello, hello. And they go to a meeting. Don't worry. Thank you. So I've somehow tried to train my ego to say, I have to give up. I have to give up. Because when I give up, I open the channel. I open the channel, allow all the power to come in, to allow me to be guided. And if you're new, this is what can happen to you. 3 more minutes, Lee, on your tape. I promised them. Well, I'm also going to do the traditions. Oh, no, no. Guaranteed a certain time. If you're new, this program is so much fun. It is just a delight. We specialize in the joy of living. But you have to be open to it. You have to be willing to say, I'm totally going to join these guys and gals. I'm going to throw my lot in with them. I'm going to just discard my old way of living. All you have to do is not drink and change everything there is about you. There's just those little 2 steps. And abandon ideas, your old ideas, like you throw away weight on a balloon so you can go up higher. Chuck C. talks about that. Uncover, discover, discard. What else am I wrong about? Hit that. Get it out of here. Get it out of here. What else do I have wrong? Am I prejudiced about? Gone, gone, gone. Just get all that out of there so that we can hear the guidance, the still small voice. Character defects make a lot of noise. resentments go, and you can't hear this wonderful little voice that's going, all is well, Mary. You are loved. I love you. Everything is perfect. If you could just hear that from the inside, you'd be sober, really sober. And we can have that on a daily basis by just following instructions. Higher power does not select somebody to love and somebody to not love. If you feel you're unlovable, you're wrong. Another idea. Bye. Get rid of it. Stupid idea. A lot of stupid ideas. If you will just open and embrace this, you will celebrate life for the rest of your life. God bless you.